Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Radio 89.1 FM, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. My name is Pat Schlarbaum. I have the privilege of working with the Wildlife Diversity Program with the Department of Natural Resources. I will be your host for today with
KHOI reporter Susan Franzen. Hi, Pat.
Yes. Today we're going to explore the topic of the Christmas bird count.
Would you tell us exactly what is the bird count?
Well, actually, the best people to give you that story are the organizers of the Ames Count, Shane Patterson, and the organizer of the Sailorville Count, Steve Dinsmore. And they were kind enough to come into KHOI studios for an interview a couple weeks ago, just after their counts were held on the weekend of December 14th and 15th. So let's listen in.
And I'm Steve Dinsmore. I'm a professor in the Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. And I have a long connection with Christmas bird counts. I was a participant back in the 1970s when I was less than 10 years old. And then I gradually got more involved and now compiled the Sailorville Reservoir Christmas bird count here in Central Iowa, which celebrated its 25th anniversary this year.
And I'm Jane Patterson. I coordinate the Iowa Breeding Bird Atlas. I also work for the Wildlife Diversity Program with Pat Schlarbaum and various others at the Boone Wildlife Research Station. And I recently coordinated the Ames Christmas bird count last Saturday. And like Steve, I've been involved in Christmas bird counts for several years now, and my interest and my participation rate grew, and I eventually became the coordinator compiler of the Ames count. And I've been doing that since 2006.
I think many of our listeners probably don't know what the Christmas bird count is and its significance and scope.
Well, the first was held in 1900 at a few locations across North America, primarily in the northeastern U.S. And the genesis behind the concept for the Christmas bird count was this practice called a side hunt. Prior to that, there would be groups, individuals who'd go out and compete by hunting to see who could shoot the most animals in a given area on a certain day. Birds, mammals, anything. Whoever brought back the biggest bag of feathers and fur was the winner. Somebody thought, let's apply that to something a little less aggressive. Let's do it in terms of counting birds so we can monitor bird populations, look at trends to see how birds are doing. If they're increasing, if they're decreasing. So they started that Christmas bird count. And ever since 1900, it's grown across the country, and there are over 2,000 locations across North America and Mexico and the Pacific that now have Christmas bird counts. And the concept behind it is there's a 15-mile diameter area in which you count all the birds that you see and hear on a given day, and that day occurs between December 14th and January 5th. You pick a day during that time, and that's when you hold your count. And for example, with the Ames count, what I always do is hold it on that first Saturday within that window so we can continue a tradition that people always come back for. And like I mentioned earlier, one of the goals of Christmas bird counts is to monitor bird populations, look at trends, see how all of our birds are doing. And it's nice that we can get people from both the game side of the spectrum and the non-game spectrum participating in Christmas bird counts. Everyone from hardcore birders like Steve Dinsmore to backyard birders who watch their feeders. In fact, we have something called a feeder watch that you can do on the Christmas bird count day where you count all the birds you see in your yard and areas of your yard that are not visible to the other counters and then report that to the compiler who then adds that into the total. So we get people of all ages and backgrounds, both professional biologists and then amateur ornithologists. And many of those amateur ornithologists are very knowledgeable about birds and wildlife.
Yeah, so Shane gave a great introduction to that, and I guess a couple things come to mind. Like Shane said, it's a 15-mile diameter circle, and those are placed sort of subjectively. There's a requirement that a local bird group, usually a local Audubon chapter, step in as the sponsor of that. And so the circle is set with a center point. You draw your radius. You have that area that's counted. And then compilers like Shane and myself will recruit teams of local birders and feeder watchers to basically provide that single day coverage. And so in addition to counting all the birds, there's some standardizations about keeping track of the weather conditions, about keeping track of your effort in the field. And so at the end of the day, you have something about sort of the environmental conditions of the count. You know about how many people were out there. You know how much time in terms of the number of hours they spent out there. And all that information collectively across the 2,000 count circles in North and Central America is utilized, like Shane said, to analyze changes in the winter distribution of birds throughout those regions. So it's a really useful tool to monitor that. The other thing I'd add is that the tradition about it being centered on Christmas really comes down to the knowledge that people have a little bit more time off then. So in many parts of North America, late December, early January might not be the heart of winter. Certainly it's not here in Iowa, as we've seen with the weather we had this last weekend. So, but also if you hold it in January, sort of the dead of winter, it's a little harder to find people that can participate. So holding that around the holidays sort of enhances the participation rate and really makes for a good coverage of those count circles across the country.
How do you recruit your bird watchers?
I think, like Shane may have alluded to, there's a lot of tradition in that. So certainly here in Ames, there are a number of folks that have been participating in the Ames Christmas Bird Count for many, many years. I mean, I started on the Ames Christmas Count in the 1970s and participate sporadically to this day. There are people that have been around a lot longer than that. So there's sort of a tradition through the local Audubon chapters. And then, you know, as new birders or people become interested in that, they're recruited to those ranks so that hopefully the participation rate continues to grow.
And the local Big Blue Stem Audubon group is a great organization for people that want to connect with the backyard bird. Monitoring of your bird feeders is probably as easy of an access to something that's much broader, and people have a nice opportunity with the Big Blue Stem Audubon group here.
So if someone is interested in participating next year, they would contact their Audubon group. Is that your recommendation?
That's one way of doing it. Another great way is to look through the National Audubon website, find the closest Christmas bird count circle to you, and you'll find out who the compiler, the coordinator for that count is, and contact the compiler directly. And that's what a lot of people do with me. They're individuals in Ames who become known as birders. They get more entrenched in birding groups, and they find out who I am and what I do. And I invite them or they contact me to participate in the count. So we keep adding on to our count group as the years go by. In fact, this year we had over 40 people participating. And in past years, we consistently get in the low to mid-30s, which is very good compared to many counts across the state. But I was very pleased to see, especially this year, the number of new counters that we had, both young and old, coming out over the weekend.
Another great resource for finding out about Christmas bird counts here in Iowa is the Iowa Ornithologists Union. So that's the statewide birding group. So that's at a higher level than the local Audubon chapters. Has a really nice informative website. And one of the many links on there is to the various Christmas bird counts, the date that they're scheduled, and a contact person in case you're interested in participating.
This is Local Talk on KHOI, and I'm today's host, Pat Schlarbaum, with KHOI reporter
Susan Branson,
talking about the Audubon Society's Christmas bird count. And we just heard from Shane Patterson and Steve Dinsmore, who coordinated the Christmas bird count here in Ames and Sayreville, and they did this December 15th and 16th, just before the snowstorm.
How many people actually participate locally in these three bird counts?
Oh, I'm sure it's between 50 and 60 different families are included in this activity between the different bird counts.
People listening to this may be thinking, hey, this is pretty random activity. It's not all on the same day. And it's just for people's convenience during Christmas vacation. Can you explain that?
There's a lot of good things that come from the Christmas bird counts over time because of those trends that can come to light.
What does the Audubon Society do with the data when they get all of these compilations?
It's the longest standing information source database that we have. You can have the first indications of the status of birds. The migration is essentially in place and whatever characteristic that makes this year's migration unique will come to light during these Christmas bird counts. For instance, northern cardinals have noticeably improved and expanded their range, and that's been picked up through the Christmas bird counts. This Christmas bird count is the longest standing citizen-driven activity of any of the surveys in America today. Susan, our co-host, also spoke with Mark Wiedelichner, who organizes what is called the Boone Count, which covers the ledges and the surrounding area. Let's listen to what he had to say.
The presence of snow cover, to a certain extent, is helpful. If the roads are clear and not ice-covered, having some snow does a few things. One is it gives us a clearer view through the forest of things that aren't brown. So sort of looking through the forest, you can pick out the birds better in a white background. And then the other thing it does is it brings birds that might normally be out in the ag fields, it brings them often to the road edges. So you'll see Lapland longspurs, snow buntings, horned larks along the roads that might well be out there, but you couldn't notice them if there's no snow.
So you mentioned counting along the roads. Is there a temptation to do that, or is it just natural to drive along and count birds?
There's maybe four components to a bird count and collecting data. There are people that go out in the dark and listen for owls. So that's one special component, is documenting the owls that are in an area either before sunrise or sometimes even after sunset. The second component is there are feeder watching stations where people will spend a certain number of hours looking at their feeders and seeing what comes into their feeders. The third component is basically hoofing it. Being out there walking, hiking the trails, or sometimes breaking the trails. If the creeks and rivers are frozen hard enough, sometimes walking down the rivers. For the people that have town territory, actually walking up and down the streets. So that'd be the third component. But really, when you think about it, in a 15-mile diameter circle, that's many, many square miles. That's a great deal of territory to cover. And so for much of the open country, where it's privately held farm fields, the best way to get a sense of what's out there just by driving those gravel roads.
This is Local Talk on KHOI. I'm Susan Franzen, here with Pat Schlarbaum, and we are talking about the Christmas bird count. Pat, my husband Fritz Franzen has been going on Christmas bird counts for almost 40 years. He told me that if someone offered him a ticket to Central America to see a rare bird at Christmas, he would still choose to stay in Central Iowa for the Christmas bird count. So I decided to ask him more about this. His bird counting partner of this year, Rachel Simmons, was kind enough to join us for the interview.
My name is Rachel Simmons. I am a huge fan of birding. I participated a few weeks ago up in the Ames CBC, and then the next day in the Sailorville CBC, and then tomorrow Boone, and then next weekend I'll be participating again in the Carroll County Christmas bird count. I'm really looking forward to it. I will look for pretty much any excuse to go birding. My friends, in fact, all refer to me affectionately as Rachel the Bird Nerd. I have been birding since roughly 1991. I was about 9 years old when I started. Here I am today. I bird at pretty much every opportunity, no matter what the weather.
I'm Fritz Franzen, and I'm a retired chemistry professor, and I have been birding for about 40 years. I had a friend who was a member of the Ames Audubon group, and he asked me to go along. And at first, I went along just because I enjoyed being in the outdoors. I really contributed nothing to the birding whatsoever. And actually, although I've been birding for a large number of years, my birding is still almost exclusively at the Christmas counts, but I have a lot of fun.
One good thing about birding in teams, you know, you really sort of feed off each other and encourage each other. And there's always that drive to see how many species you can get. Sometimes there's a little bit of competition going on between teams, too. And it's always fun to see who can get the highest number of species, or when it comes to rare species, who sees the most northern harriers or bald eagles. It's a lot of fun.
The CBC, as birders call it, requires a lot of people with different skills and experience. You represent two very different age groups and skill sets. Rachel is in her 20s, and Fritz is in his 70s. So it would be interesting to hear how you worked together.
It was definitely a pleasure birding with him. He was willing to cover ground that I wasn't really willing to cover. You know, while I was climbing over fences and underbrush and through bramble, he kind of walked along the fence line to see what he could kick up. So he was willing to cover the quieter areas while I tromped through some of the more untamed areas with unbeaten paths. And it was definitely a pleasure birding with him.
I think that the mistake that a lot of people make when I talk to them about birding who have never been on a birding expedition is to think that it's just a piece of cake and everybody could probably has the same talent and the same ability and you just go out and see the birds. And nothing could be further from the truth. There is no limitation on who should be involved. But the fact of the matter is that some people have abilities that others don't. The same thing is true in chemistry, the same thing is true in basketball, and it's certainly true in birding. I have had the very good fortune in my life to meet several birders, a number of whom you have interviewed previously, who have extremely fast reflexes, very acute sense of what's going on around them, and also acute sense of hearing, and a lot of knowledge about where birds are and what they're doing at any particular time of the year. And Rachel worked hard to get her listening ability to the point where it is now, and I can tell you from the experience that I had birding with her, it's outstanding. I mean, we saw many of them we just heard, but we saw many more birds this year than I've seen in the previous 10 years or maybe ever on this particular count, the Ames count. And a large part of that was due to Rachel's acute hearing.
And so that's where your knowledge is so valuable.
2 weeks ago on the Ames Christmas bird count, I maybe saw 3 or 4 brown creepers. However, I heard at least 19. So, you know, had I not been able to hear those, then, you know, my list, or our final tally would have said 4 brown creepers rather than 19. So it definitely came in handy that day.
What is a lifer?
A lifer is a species that I've never before encountered in the wild. Last year on the Carroll County Christmas Bird Count, it was a northern saw-whet owl, and I was very, very excited about that. They're a rare winter visitor here in Iowa. They are basically the size of a pop can, and they really just don't draw a lot of attention to themselves. They are very tame, yet very elusive.
First saw-whet owl I ever saw came after a full day of the boom count. Barney Cook, who was the one who introduced me to Birdie, and I went in the ravines that come drain into the Des Moines River down at the north edge of the ledges, and we walked up into those ravines and we looked at every cedar tree that we could get to, and this amounted to scrambling up the sides of these steep ravines until I was completely exhausted. And I came home and I nearly dropped from exhaustion. I was just ready to go to bed when my phone rang and Barney said, "Get ready to go tomorrow. Steve Dinsmore, whom I think you've had on this program also, is going to take us and show us a saw-whet owl." And I said to myself, "I'll bet." And sure enough, 7:30 the next morning, we piled into a car. We drove back down there. We walked in about a quarter, a half mile, just an easy walk along the flat part. Turned into the first ravine, came to the first cedar trip, and he pointed. He says, "There's one right there." And it was right in front of our nose. Impressive thing about the saw-whet owl is they don't seem to be afraid of human beings. It's rather typical of a number of the Arctic species that they're so unaccustomed to being around humans that they haven't developed a sense of fear. And you can almost put your nose to theirs and they'll just sit there staring at you, and they're cute as the dickens.
Thank you.
Those are some of the sounds that we love here in Iowa. Woodpeckers, the downy, the hairy, red-bellied, red-headed, and pileated woodpeckers, and the northern flicker, which is also a woodpecker. Significant ones for the ledges are the red-headed and pileated woodpeckers, and sometimes, on special occasions, yellow-bellied sapsuckers are also seen there. This is Local Talk at KHOI Radio 89.1, and I'm today's host, Pat Schlarbaum, with KHOI reporter Susan Franson, talking about the Audubon Society's Christmas bird count. One little-known part of the Christmas bird count is the feeder count. And yes, backyard feeders are important. Shane Patterson spoke earlier, told us about Jim Pease, and Jim is a local resident with a wonderful backyard that is landscaped for songbirds. And the bird feeders in his yard are an important part of the bird count. Susan Franson, our co-host, got a special chance to see his feeders up close and personal.
I'm Jim Pease, and I'm a retired professor at Iowa State, retired Extension Wildlife Specialist. And we're very, very fortunate to have found a place back in 1993 out here on Stagecoach Road. So we're within 2 miles of the city of Ames, but we have about 10 acres here. I'm very fortunate to have a place this close to Ames that is this wild. And that's what we do, is we manage it for wildlife. And that includes birds and mammals and reptiles, amphibians, and trees and shrubs. So we try and keep it as wild as we can. One of the things we do, of course, like many bird feeders, we like to bring birds up close and personal. A lot of people think that bird feeding is to help the birds survive. Well, it does that, but if you look at the data nationally, they come into spring a little better condition and maybe have slightly larger brood size than non-fed birds. But basically, it's to get them up close to us. You know, let's admit that up front, that it really is to get them up close where we can see them. So we have a variety of feeders, 20 feeders on different sides of the house. They are all different kinds of food. As well, we have water that we keep available year-round in the form of heated bird baths and a small pond on one side of the house. So the water is also attractive. You think about the three basic needs for food, water, and cover. We try and recreate that here. So we not only have food and water available, but we have lots of shrubs planted in different places around the house, native shrubs that allow the birds to come in and feel safe close to those feeders.
You participated in the bird feeder count for the Christmas bird count.
The feeder counts supplement what the rest of the counters do in the field, going to different areas around the Ames area to count the numbers of birds we have. And of course, because feeders tend to concentrate birds in an area, it makes good sense to count them as well. And so there are a number of people around Ames that supplement the Christmas bird count with the counts of birds that come to their feeder. So my wife and I, because we have feeders on different sides of the house, we spend time in different rooms during the day and say, look, I've got 25 pine siskins. How many do you have on that side? And so we get what you do is you count several times during the day and you try and count the maximum number that you see at any given point during that day. And so that's what we turn in, is the maximum numbers that we see at one time.
Are there some years that are better than others?
Oh, yes. Yeah. This year, in fact, the Ames Christmas bird count was suffered because of kind of a rainy, crappy day is what it was. It was kind of lousy. But depending on where you are, if you're in heavy cover areas, the birds still show up. They did not feed as heavily that day as they are for today, for example. But so yeah, there's a lot of variation. If you have right before a winter storm or right during a storm, boy, the birds are feeding like crazy. They seem to know well before we do. And so those are really good days to do counts because you get the maximum numbers pretty easily because they're coming in to feed and fill up real quickly.
Are there any days when the bird feeders have relatively more than other areas?
You know, possibly, yeah, certainly more. We had a total of 19 species, which is very good, but we have terrific habitat around here as well. So it really is, whether you're feeding birds in your backyard or you're out in the landscape, it's really all about habitat. because we're more wooded here. We don't, for example, get some of the species that are more prominent, for example, down at Ada Hayden Park, where it's much more open. So there are red poles down there. We rarely get red poles up here. There may be even a few tree sparrows or something like that down there. We don't get those except in passing. They're much more open country. Some of those birds, we never get things like snow buntings and that here. But because they're more open country. But so it depends on the habitat that you're going to. So certainly the birds are more concentrated here around the feeders, but they're not necessarily more common. I think it just depends on what habitat you're looking for.
Do you have any of the predator birds, like the hawks?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we occasionally get both the sharpshin and coopers that come in. And these are bird feeders, after all. And they're birds as well, so we're feeding them as well.
It gives a different meaning to bird
feeder.
That's
right. That's right.
One part of Jim's interview that may be of general interest is his advice on how to most effectively attract birds to your feeders.
It's amazing how much Americans spend on just wild birds. Iowans spend $45 million on wild bird seed every year. That's an amazing amount. If you can only feed one thing, my recommendation is black oil sunflower seed, because that feeds the widest variety of birds and attracts the greatest number, and it has the highest food value for them. But the more different kinds of things you feed in different locations, as long as they are close to some cover that they can get to, and you feed at different levels as well, some down low, some up high. Juncos, for example, like to feed on the ground. So do white-throated sparrows. They'll feed on the ground under the feeders, but others like to feed up high. The cardinals like to have an open platform, whereas other birds like this white-breasted nuthatch that we're seeing out here right now will feed, and the pine siskins will feed right at the feeders. So you have different kinds of feeders in different locations with different kinds of feed in. You will maximize the numbers and the numbers of species and the numbers of individuals that you attract.
One of the things that I wondered about after talking to Jim was, what about cats? My neighbor has three outside cats, and I've stopped feeding. But I would like to put bird feeders in my yard, but I don't want to create an attractive nuisance. I really used to enjoy having a lot of birds at my feeders. Now, do you have any suggestions about how I could accommodate both?
Well, we've discussed the cover issue that songbirds really require. Sometimes that cover, which would be in the form of shrubs, can be an advantage to the cats. Cats do what they do very well, and they're a pretty good predator. So by exposing or keeping an open space around your bird feeders, Jim Pease mentioned the different locations and height advantages. So try to complement your bird feeding areas with some cover for the birds, but not cover so close that it is an advantage to the cats. So hopefully we can all coexist with our feline neighbors also.
So you think it's really possible?
Yes, I even encourage it, because we're not going to eliminate all the cats, and we certainly want to appreciate our birds. So let's just try to figure out how to coexist and make it work. Some people put a bell on their cat. There's some things you can do.
Actually, somebody suggested that if you go to a bird food store, that you might ask for their advice.
Yes, and quite often they're on the cutting edge of what's occurring locally. We try to just work with our cat neighbors, and we try to work with the birds. This is Local Talk at KHOI 89.1 Story City, Ames, and I'm today's host, Pat Schlarbaum, with KHOI reporter Susan Franzen, talking about the Audubon Society's Christmas Bird Count. And one of the things that we haven't mentioned yet is how children and families can be involved in birding. A family that has participated has stopped by our studios to tell about what it means to them. Certainly privileged to have such a wonderful conservation-minded family in the studios this morning. Amy Yoakum, Mike Hovlig, and 6-year-old Max Hovlig.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Max, what is your favorite bird?
Sharpshin.
A sharp-shinned hawk?
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you describe that bird to me? How about his wings?
They are brown a little.
How about his tail?
Banded on the tail, back banded.
Yeah, and a real sturdy tail that allows him to maneuver through the understory because they chase other birds, don't they?
Yep.
What did we see yesterday when we were outside?
Sharp-shinned goat, and we didn't see it kill anything, but we thought it killed like a grackle or something, and it's like all the starlings flew up.
Well, when you go out on your family outings, do you have a certain time limit, or are you just out experiencing nature?
We're just out experiencing nature.
Well, Amy, a lot of your work is oriented towards the youth, tomorrow's conservationists. What's it mean to you to have your son accompanying you on these outings?
I think for me, I remember my aha moment when I understood birds. And, you know, I grew up running around outside in the woods. And when I was in college, I took a field ornithology class at Iowa Lakeside Lab. And I discovered the bird I had been hearing my entire life was called a song sparrow because I learned it by call. And so even though I grew up being aware of birds, that they were all around me all the time, that they all made different noises and were different colors, when I was able to put a name on a sound, that's when my world really kind of changed as far as bird watching goes. So that's what I have done with my career, is to help give young children those connections and those aha moments as far as bird watching goes as well. And we're happy that we can share that hobby with our family.
Yeah, that's super. How about some of those calls? Could you know the call of the barred owl?
Mm-hmm.
You want to try that one for us, please? Ooh, yeah, that works pretty good. Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all?
Did we see one this year in the Christmas bird count?
Yes.
Yeah. What was it doing?
It was just, it landed in a tree. I didn't see it until it finally flew off.
What are some other calls that you know?
I know a crow.
Can you do it? We have a few of those around here, don't we? How about the belted kingfisher? You remember that one?
Real rattle trap.
How long have you been doing that call? Do you remember when you first learned that?
Since I was 2 or 3.
Mm-hmm. You make that one at a very young age. And what's the woodpecker one that you can do?
Oh, I believe that's a pileated woodpecker. Yeah. And you know, when I was your age, they were in eastern Iowa. But we didn't really have them here in central Iowa. Now, their range is expanding. So there, occasionally we have a success story when you can kind of take pileated woodpeckers for granted. But there was a time when that was pretty rare here in central Iowa. But now they're seeing it up in northwest Iowa, Christmas bird counts. So that's pretty positive.
Good one here in Ames this year.
Yeah,
there was one
probably the first time, yes. I believe, wasn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, pileated woodpecker. For those of our listeners, you know, we have quite a suite of woodpeckers, northern flickers being one, but then there's the downy woodpeckers, hairy woodpeckers, red-headed woodpeckers. But this pileated woodpecker, he's probably the woody woodpecker of all the...
Same size as a crow.
Yeah.
It's an impressive sight, and even though they're big, they're very secretive. So
very secretive, but they are nesting along the Des Moines River. Well, Mike, some of your experiences up there at the Y Camp is directed towards the youth.
Yes.
The best hope for
I would tell
future.
You early on in my job career, I wanted to teach knowledge. I just wanted to give them information. And I thought that's for sure would get these kids excited and motivated and teach them the names. And what I found out pretty early on is it's the experiences. We need to give them experiences, and then they will find and ask the questions themselves. We don't need to tell them about climate change or tell them about what's happening in the old growth forest. Let them have the experiences and teach them, give them the tools to identify birds, and then they'll come to those places themselves.
People have a tendency to seek their own answers, but I agree.
Why do we like to watch birds, Max?
Because it's fun, and you can watch their lives, and...
They're pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you go last spring?
To see the sandhill cranes.
Oh, my.
And what state did you have to go to for that one?
Nebraska.
Nebraska. You know, we have sandhill cranes also nesting here in central Iowa, over at Otter Creek Marsh on the Iowa River, a little bit beyond our listening coverage. But for those that would like to connect with sandhill cranes, what was the thing you enjoyed most about sandhill cranes?
You've seen hundreds and hundreds of them.
Oh, yeah, they darken the sky, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Here today, I think this is a great celebration, if you will, because you are a family that is truly living what your hearts are seeking. And if birds can help us along the way, all the better.
Families don't have to be involved in something as organized as the Christmas Bird Count to enjoy birding. Steve Dinsmore and Sean Patterson have a few suggestions of resources available to those in our listening area.
I think other groups like the Iowa Ornithologist Union more broadly has tried to provide opportunities for youth birders to attend, for example, the annual meetings or the semi-annual meetings of the IOU. Mm-hmm. And they've provided some small scholarships to try and stimulate young birders to attend that in the past. And so the Iowa Young Birders is something that's mm-hmm. grown beyond that and is much broader and more focused. But nonetheless, lots of good efforts to try and recruit the next generation.
Carl Bendorf has initiated a Iowa Young Birders group that is catching wind and a lot of support, and it's a part of the Iowa Ornithologist Union website. So Carl Bendorf is a great mentor, and there's a good chance that young people will get their initiation into the greater environmental picture through a lot of Carl's initial work now. So yes, bringing on the next generation is what we all strive for. We know that the best hope for the future lies in our youth.
This is Susan Franzen. There are a lot of websites that you could check. I have just three here: iowayoungbirders.org, iowabirds.org, and iowaaudubon/events.org. Now you could Google National Audubon for information about future Christmas bird counts that were recommended earlier. And thank you so much for being our host today, Pat Schwarbaum. Pat, why do you love birds?
Birds have a special place in our hearts, bringing us uplifting moments. On a walk, you've just been joined by something in our creation that's beautiful and sounds beautiful. And
robins are what I remember from my childhood in Kansas.
Yeah. My first recognition of songbirds in our farm in southern Iowa were pointed out by my mother were the goldfinches and big flocks of goldfinches. So we were by the garden and we still had grapes, and the goldfinches were kind of flittering through the leaves of the grapevine, and then as I saw them swirl up, I was struck that moment as they terraced along through the blue sky, their immaculate yellow color. I was just a little toddler, but I do remember the goldfinches for the first time and my mother pointing them out. This week's program was made with production assistance from Cynthia McClure and Ursula Rudenberg, Richard Morrison engineered. Music and bird sounds you heard during the past hour included John Barleycorn by Traffic from their album John Barleycorn Must Die. The bird calls were from Birding by Ear with the Peterson Field Guides by Richard Walton and Robert Lawson. Backyard Birds by Nature Song. And our theme song for Local Talk is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
We have a lot of thank yous today, starting with James Dinsmore, Shane Patterson, Mark Wiederlichner, Jim Pease, Doug Haar, A.B. Yoakum, Mike Havlick, Max Havlick, Rachel Simmons, Fritz Franzen, Carl Bendorf, and Jerry Keyes. Hope you have a great day.
And we will leave you with George Shearing's rendition of Lullaby of Birdland.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.